On the program today, we are focusing on some interesting health issues that might be on your mind after a week of holiday meals and family gatherings. Later, we will tell you about some interesting new findings about depression in new mothers who are living in multi-generational households. But we're going to start by talking about obesity, which affects one in three Americans. Last year, you might remember, the American Medical Association, the nation's largest physicians group, classified obesity as a disease. AMA officials hoped the change would steer more medical attention to obesity. But now a new study says people actually make poorer diet choices when they think of obesity as a disease. The study is from the journal Psychological Science. Crystal Hoyt is the lead author, and she's with us now from member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Crystal Hoyt, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Michelle.
And for additional perspective, we've also called Dr. Leslie Walker, chief of adolescent medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. Among her duties is counseling her patients on nutrition and weight, and she's with us from member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Walker, welcome back to you. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Crystal, I'm going to start with you. Your team did three separate experiments with more than 700 participants, and you found that obese participants who read a news article about the AMA declaring obesity a disease were less likely to be concerned about their weight and more likely to choose high-calorie food. So, first, I'm curious about what gave you the idea to test this idea, and why do you think the findings turned out as they did?
So as a social psychologist, as soon as the AMA decided to label obesity as a disease, I was interested in the impact of this label, the psychological impact on of this label on people. Might it be the case that thinking that one has a disease makes people think that weight's unchangeable and attempts at weight management seem pointless? So my colleagues, Jenny Burnett, Lisa Oster-Gussman, and I decided to test this research.
And why do you think? And so you think that what it was kind of a disinhibitor, where people felt, well, there's nothing I can do. Is that what you think happened?
Exactly. What we think is going on here is that the disease message shifts people's beliefs regarding the controllability of body weight. Right. So psychologists call these beliefs, whether we think human attributes can be fixed or changeable, mindsets. In this case, we have weight mindsets, and a fixed mindset's a belief that regardless of effort, my weight's relatively stable. Whereas a growth mindset's the belief that, well, with hard work, I can change my weight.
Mm. And did find that the disease classification had a good impact on people's body image.
Exactly. So on the positive side, we found that the obesity as a disease message increased body satisfaction among obese individuals, and probably did so because it removed the shame of obesity as a moral failing.
So Dr. Walker, what do you make of these findings? Dr. Walker? I think, have we lost Dr. Walker? Okay. All right. Well, Crystal Hoyt, one of the things we were interested in talking about is this whole question of whether disease versus chronic medical condition. You know, is there a difference? Some people, I know some physicians prefer a chronic medical condition instead of a disease. Is there a difference in that? What does that mean?
That's a good question. What does that mean? And so as a disclaimer, we haven't conducted any research on, you know, what's the impact of labeling something a chronic medical condition. Our interest in thinking of the disease label was because people see disease as a fixed chronic state and one in which that we don't have a lot of control over.
So Dr. Walker, I take it you're back?
Yes.
Happy about that?
Yes, okay.
Well, you know what we're talking about here. And the question is, you know, I understand that you prefer not to use the word disease and you prefer a chronic medical condition. What difference does that make?
Well, I mean, it's what it is. It's a chronic medical condition. It's not something that, you know, a person could do a diet and they're better. You know, it's a lifelong work and lifestyle change. Most adults that are obese were obese as kids. And you know, there's a lot of reasons beyond just diet and exercise that people become obese, and it's not something that's easily fixed. And people need to understand that and understand that it's not just about their self-control or losing control with food. There's a lot that goes into somebody becoming obese, and there's a lot that goes into trying to manage that and be healthy.
Have you, when the AMA made this announcement that they were going to start using this terminology obesity as a disease, is that something that you incorporated in your discussions with patients right away?
That's something, talking about it being a chronic medical condition, an actual condition, and not just something that has to do with people's self-control, I've always talked about. And, you know, in some ways we were very happy that it is categorized that way, because right now insurance doesn't cover all the, you know, nutritionists or the, you know, the team. Like we have a team of people that works on our obesity program for adolescents and young adults, and it's not covered by insurance. And so it would be nice to have the things that we know that have evidence base that work for people to help them be covered, and having it actually categorized is one step toward having that happen.
Have you observed, though, what the researchers led by Crystal Hoyt have observed, too, which is this, that in some patients and some of the people you work with, it kind of removes some of the incentive to take these positive steps. Have you seen that?
Well, I think what I would see that as is it's removing some of the pain that people have. And, you know, to be obese, you deal with daily discrimination, bullying, feeling guilty, shame, you know, that it's your fault that you can't just manage this. And to hear that maybe it's not completely your fault, that maybe there's something else going on beyond your self-control, might give people a little more release to say, man, maybe I don't have to try to drink this Diet Coke all the time. Maybe I don't have to eat just one pea and, you know, and really feel hungry. Maybe I can eat something I want once in a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're really working with people to help them manage this, it's about having a different relationship with food and not feeling so guilty. That's one of the things that helps. And it could be that they're beginning to see that and feel less guilty.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about classifying obesity as a disease. We're talking about new research that says that classifying the obesity as a disease may affect people's diet and health choices. Our guests are physician Dr. Leslie Walker, that's who was speaking just now. Also, psychology professor Crystal Hoyt, whose research found that people are actually making poorer diet choices when they are exposed to this information that obesity is a disease. So, Crystal Hoyt, what about that? I mean, I understand that you can see where, I'm sure you can understand Dr. Walker's point of view from kind of a clinical perspective, trying to give people, remove some of the stigma, which might open up the opportunity for people to address this issue. But your findings suggest that really, at least in the short run, having been confronted with this, that people were actually kind of working less hard to address this. How do you want people to address these findings, Crystal Hoyt?
Yes. So while our findings do show psychological costs in terms of self-regulation and deciding where obese individuals place less focus on health-focused dieting, less concern for weight, ultimately predicting higher calorie food choices, that's one psychological outcome. And what Dr. Walker's pointing to is another very important potential psychological outcome of labeling obesity as a disease, in that it might usher in a greater tolerance and serve to decrease discrimination against obese individuals. And that's actually the current line of research that we are exploring in our lab.
Tell me more about that, Crystal Hoyt, if you would. That was going to be my next question, which is, what are some of the other things you're interested in learning about and researching?
So right now we are looking at this idea of, is it the case, and how is it the case, that perhaps labeling obesity a disease decreases this stigma, a self-stigma, and we kind of found that in our research, where obese individuals felt less body dissatisfaction, were more satisfied with their body, but might it also decrease the stigma that others have against them? And we know, I'm a social psychologist, and in my field and in other related fields, we know that reducing stigma against individuals, such as the overweight, can be useful in enabling them to attain their goals, such as weight loss.
Dr. Walker, what about the, is there an analogy here with substance addiction, with drug addiction? You know, for decades now, people have referred to substance addiction as a disease. And I wonder if that has had the same kind of effect. I mean, on the one hand, food is different in that it might be hard to avoid those substances that you're addicted to, like alcohol or you know, drugs, but you don't need them to live, whereas food you do need to live. So that's kind of a different scenario. But have you seen with patients that have drug addictions or substance addictions that the idea of categorizing it as a disease, have you found that to be helpful or disinhibiting in the same way that you see with food?
Yeah, I think it is. It is helpful because people realize that there's something more going on here. You know, when you have something, and you know, addiction is a disease. We can see it now. We have the evidence looking at the brain that, you know, your brain changes when addiction occurs, and it you know, the drive is enormous to use. And so people understanding that, and us and as researchers understanding how to address it in that way, makes us get a little bit closer to really being able to deal with it. And it is hard because, you know, when you're having obesity, you you still have to eat, and that's your trigger. And, you know, it's right there in front of you every day. You need it, and it's very difficult. And I think moving forward, we can find ways to help manage that a little better if we see it differently.
Crystal Hoyt, can I give you the final word here? What would you like people to draw from this study?
I guess my final word or advice would be the importance of mindsets and how crucial they are for individuals beginning to diet and continue to try and reach their dieting goals. Research by my colleague Jenny Burnett and others shows very clearly that believing that weight is changeable, that is, having a growth mindset, sustains motivation and predicts greater weight loss than having a fixed mindset.
Crystal Hoyt is a psychology professor at the University of Richmond. She's author of the study Obesity as a Disease in the journal Psychological Science. Dr. Leslie Walker is chief of adolescent medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. I thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Small startups like Aereo often turn to big tech companies to provide the infrastructure that makes up the cloud. Two of the biggest are Amazon and Google, and a price war between those companies over their cloud services could affect the future of innovation on the internet. NPR's Elise Hugh reports.
If you've ever watched streaming TV on Netflix, clicked on a Pinterest pin, or listened to music on Spotify, you've used Amazon Web Services. It's part of the same Amazon family that sells you stuff online. But Amazon Web Services, or AWS, is a different arm of the company. Matt Wood is its chief data scientist.
We delivered computing power as if it was a utility.
Internet companies need infrastructure like processing power and data storage to run their businesses. A decade ago, that meant startups had to set up their own data centers and computing backbones. Now, cloud platforms like Amazon's provide that infrastructure by letting companies just rent it out at a low cost. Think of it as the difference between generating your own power at home or just getting electricity from a grid.
They can draw down exactly the right amount of energy that they need, whether it's to light a light or to run a fridge, and they only pay for that electricity as and when they use it, and they pay for it for as much or as little as they need as they're using it. So we offer computational resources in exactly the same way.
The effect for you is that new services, apps, and startup companies can spin up quickly without much cost, and those companies can adjust to your needs faster.
And that nimbleness that startups are so famous for is just as valuable inside large organizations.
The 8-year-old Amazon Web Services was a pioneer in offering pay-as-you-go computing, and it makes big money, an estimated $3.8 billion in revenue last year. Its head start means AWS has had a near monopoly on large-scale cloud computing. A 2013 report estimates Amazon controlled 5 times the computing power of the next 14 cloud providers combined. But competition is growing fierce.
There will not be just one company that's the cloud provider. There'll be several.
Greg DiMichele is Google's cloud platform manager. Google recently slashed prices for its cloud services by 80%, starting a price war that the companies find themselves in now.
We're going to continue to be very aggressive on that.
Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and others are competing to be the main landlords of the cloud. It matters because the winner will have a lot of control over the internet. Their choices affect issues like data privacy, and as virtual landlords, their terms could control who gets to build what on the internet and for how much.
Snapchat didn't exist 3 years ago. You can go down the list of apps that you probably have on your Android phone or your iPhone. Those exist because cloud platforms enable two developers with an idea to launch a service.
Gartner analyst David Smith says the price war is more about money than innovation.
So if you had people on the 99-year lease type thing, going back to your landlord analogy, I think that's more the connection. You're locking people in. So once they're there, it's difficult for them to move. That's the control point.
For now, this competition means much cheaper bills for internet businesses, as Google's DiMichele points out.
That's good for consumers. It's good for developers. It makes cloud accessible to even more developers who have more financial constraints. So, you know, we just think it's a good thing for everybody.
Prices have fallen so fast that Amazon, the reigning cloud king, doesn't rule out the possibility that prices for services could wind up close to zero. Matt Wood.
Yeah, I mean, where we can achieve better economies of scale, we'll continue to pass those savings on to our customers.
A high-stakes battle for the cloud, resulting in low, low prices. Elise Hu, NPR News.
We're continuing our look at how Americans pay for college. Income inequality is a greater barrier to college than in years past. Here's our colleague David Green.
We've heard about skyrocketing tuition, and also we've heard from college grads who are saddled with debt. This morning, another voice, Suzanne Mettler from Cornell University. In her new book, Degrees of Inequality, she says government aid once helped make college an engine of upward mobility.
From the creation of the GI Bill in 1944 up through Pell Grants in 1972, we had all of these federal student aid policies being created that were enabling more and more people to become the first in their families to go to college. And also states were investing more than ever in public universities and colleges, and those really broadened access to college.
But Mettler argues that American higher education today is actually increasing economic inequality and fostering social division. She tracked some of the changes with us. First, Pell Grants. Once many Americans could count on federal help for a lot of their college bills.
Back in the 1970s, we had Pell Grants that were covering 80% of the cost of tuition fees and room and board for someone to attend the average four-year public university.
So this would help people in all different incomes get to college.
Yes.
Today, Pell Grants cover just a quarter of that cost, and those same public universities themselves are also losing funding.
There's been a dramatic reduction in the amount that states invest in these schools.
States are just not investing as much in public universities, and so tuitions are having to go up.
Yes, that's right. And the other problem is that the universities and colleges, in order to make ends meet, are cutting back on resources for students. So they're squeezing more students into the classroom. The faculty-to-student ratio has grown much larger, and they are pushing more students into online courses. And it turns out that all of these transformations diminish graduation rates. And they have the biggest impact on the low to middle income people for whom higher education should really be providing that path to upward mobility.
In your book, you talked about the government policies have been shifting resources away from lower income students to more affluent students. And one example you bring up from during the Clinton administration was giving tax credits for college tuition. Tell me why you're not a fan of that.
Well, it turns out that these tuition tax relief policies mostly help people who would go to college anyway. And actually, the initial ones were targeted to lower middle income people. Over time, they've been increased and expanded, and now they go to families with incomes up to $180,000. And the biggest amount of them goes to families that are close to that limit.
If you were to look at a lower income student who is interested in going to college, say 30, 40 years ago, and a lower income student who has that same dream today, how does the world look differently to those two people?
For most students who are low to middle income, they're going to be going to public sector universities and colleges that have had these dramatic reductions in spending from the states over time and are really trying to squeeze resources. And so even if they had relatives that went to the same universities back in the 1970s, they're not able to get the same experience today because they have to pay so much more for it, and there's been such a reduction in resources.
Let me just ask, there are some who would look at the current landscape and might say, you know, states are very cash-strapped. They have to make difficult decisions about what they invest in. And, you know, it's sort of a market out there. I mean, if affluent families can afford private colleges and people who have less money have different options. What is wrong with that scenario?
I think we don't want a system of higher education that just separates Americans into separate tiers, like some kind of a caste system. Part of the educational experience is that it's really important for students in the classroom to be able to interact with people different from themselves, from different backgrounds.
I just want to ask you about the caste system that you're describing. If we look after college, what impact does that have on students and sort of what their options are and what the country looks like?
Well, we have more students than ever who enroll in college. And so at the front end, it can look like we're really, as a nation, facilitating greater upward mobility. For students who are able to attend colleges that invest a lot in their students, they are able to have small classes, lots of interaction with faculty, and to have that experience that can really transform their lives in all sorts of ways. But for other students who go to college and find themselves mostly in online classes or squeezed into very large classrooms where a professor is not going to know their name, the outcomes can be very different indeed. Their likelihood of graduating becomes much lower with those experiences, and what they're able to gain from it much less.
Professor Mettler, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Suzanne Mettler from Cornell University. Her book is called Degrees of Inequality.
And now the regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the songs on their playlists. We caught up with entertainer Margaret Cho during her latest comedy tour, and she gave us a few of her favorite tunes.
My name is Margaret Cho. I am a comedian, an actor, an author, and I do lots of other things like music. And part of my obsession with music is that my love of songs, and I have a lot of favorite songs. The one that I'm listening to nonstop right now is Cuddly Toy by Harry Nielsen. This is one of the greatest songs ever written and recorded, and it's really something that's more familiar to people from the Monkees television show. It's something that Davy Jones sang, but actually, in truth, it's a Harry Nielsen song, and it is really, really fantastic. It's got a little bit of Beatles influence there. It's from the golden age of music.
I never told you that I love no other. You must have dreamed it in your sleep. You're not the only cuddly toy that was ever enjoyed by any boy. You're not the only choo-choo train that was left out in the rain the day after Santa came. La-la-la-la-la-la-la.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you.
Another song that really just gets to me is God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, which is another great, great, great song of the 60s. And Brian Wilson's melodies and his harmonies are just unbeatable and really incredible. I'm just, a huge music fan, and those are the songs I'm listening to right now in my ear.
Believe me, the world could show nothing to me.
That was comedian Margaret Cho telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear our previous conversation with her, head over to NPR.org, click on the Programs tab, and go to Tell Me More.
As our listeners know, commentator Frank DeFord has been covering sports for a long time, and he's seen many changes in the sports world, including the questions he gets from fans.
When I was a young, cocksure lad in this business, one thing I hated was for anyone in the old guard to preface an observation about sports by saying, "It used to be." Invariably, the point was that it used to be better. I promised myself that I'd never become a used-to-be guy. But for the benefit of today's young cocksure lads, here I go anyway. It used to be that people always asked me if these athletes weren't making too much money. Nobody ever asked me that anymore. Never. The only money issue I hear is why aren't college athletes paid? It used to be nobody ever asked me that. Never. It used to be that people always complained to me about how television was taking over sports with TV timeouts and different starting times. Nobody ever complains to me about that anymore. Never. All they complain to me about is when they can't get a game that they want to see on TV. It used to be that people asked me how many games were really fixed because they'd heard it was lots, as if I knew. They don't ask me about fixes anymore. Never. Instead, people ask me how many athletes are doping because they heard for sure that it's lots more. It used to be that people would ask me why Americans didn't like soccer. Now people ask me why the American media won't give soccer its proper due because Americans really, really do like soccer. It used to be people wanted to know if athletes actually cheated on their wives that much on the road. Nobody ever asks me that anymore. Instead, they ask me if I think sports contributes to misogyny because so many athletes are involved in brutal sexual assaults on women. It used to be people always asked me who I thought the greatest boxer was, as if I knew. They stopped asking that, and then it used to be they'd ask me if boxing was ever going to come back. Nobody ever asked me about boxing anymore, anything, ever. It used to be that people would tell me how sports builds character. Now that athletes are regularly arrested for violent crimes and that so many college athletes are participating in a giant fraud that the academic community supports, people don't tell me that anymore. Instead, they ask me dubiously, do you really think sports builds character? It used to be that people would tell me they were going out to play golf. I don't hear that much anymore, except from old folks. Now people tell me they can't play golf because they have to work longer hours and it takes too long. It used to be that people would always ask me who I thought was going to win the game, as if I knew. Now people always ask me who I think is going to win the game, as if I know. Well, some things never change.
Yes, it used to be commentator Frank DeFord joined us each week here on Morning Edition from NPR News, and he still does. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.